Let us bring the world to you. We may be quite restricted in where we can go and what is safe to do right now, but we promise to bring you a world of music every Monday through Friday from 2 until 4. We have lots of other great international music on our weekly broadcast schedule. To see all of our programs and everything WEFT has to offer conveniently, head over to our website. The website is www.weft.org. There you can get a look at all of our amazing programming, news, music, community affairs. You can also see how you can support WEFT with a donation of whatever size is right for you. We operate based on listener donations, so please don't forget about us, even in these tough times. We want to be here going strong for you at 90.1 FM and broadcasting live on the web at www.weft.org.
I want to let you know that this afternoon from 2 to 5 p.m. is the last scheduled date of the Monk Retrospective at the Independent Media Center, where Cope Compston and Meg Miller and others have assembled a variety of artifacts and artworks from Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk. There may still be some prints available and programs available, and even small size clothes that were silk screened many, many years ago by Dave and various helpers. So again, last day for the retrospective show today at the IMC, the old Urbana Post Office on the north side of Lincoln Square, 2 to 5 p.m. There's also a nice write-up about the show in Smile Politely, which is an online review, if you will, smilepolitely.com. My name is Bill Saylor, and today I am bringing you a rebroadcast of a Prairie Monk program that we broadcast, well, we first aired it live, this week 20 years ago. On August 25th, 2002. And mostly that's coincidence, because mainly I was attracted by the variety of reminiscences about Australia in this program from Dave. So there's a lot of that. But do keep in mind, it was 20 years ago, and things have certainly changed since then. He mentioned some family, including his brother Jeff, who is no longer with us. But he was still around for quite some time after this mention, by which time he was already diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And Dave also mentions a niece in this episode, which I don't think is the niece you may be acquainted with from more recent visits to Weft and to Urbana. In any case, the Prairie Monk Program, August 25th, 2002, bringing it back to you today. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM.
Blue railroad train, and going down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line.
This is Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. And
I'm Bill Saylor. Thanks for joining us. This is our weekly environmental, well, our look at something environmental in your landscape or one familiar to us, and that might be this week's.
First of all,
refrigerators.
This is the environmental portion of the show, I think.
Environmental portion of this show.
I started to figure out that I was drinking sour milk, and so I did a little investigating and found out that the freeze box wasn't freezing either, and the motor was still running. So what do you do with refrigerators? How do you handle them? I mostly have work with second-hand refrigerators. It has varying advantages and disadvantages. One is that refrigerators have improved themselves remarkably in the last few years. So if you started off with a refrigerator, probably in the 20s, you would usually had a kerosene refrigerator. You didn't have, especially if people had no rural electrification, you had a heater in there, and you fill up with kerosene every day, or perhaps not every day, but you'd have a reservoir, and that was what ran the refrigerator. Basically, you're heating up the gas, which comes back and does the cooling through adiabatic effect. If I remember rightly, it's pushing something through a very small hole and taking heat out of the surround by the expansion of the molecules as they come out. Later, you had compressors that did that task rather than heaters, and compressors were fairly noisy. You take fright sometimes if you're sitting in the kitchen and the refrigerator went on. But gradually they got them seal units and floating in oil more or less, and the efficiency is still not large. And as the refrigerators get old, one of the main things is that the lining around the doors gets weak. The plastic or the rubber-based material, which has an elasticity in the early stages, loses some of that elasticity, and it lets air come in, and then you have a defrosting problem. Well, I had one of those old refrigerators, which I thought could be used as a backup for the other, and but it needed defrosting, so I needed to defrost it quickly because what was in my refrigerator was going to go out of action. I didn't get it cool fairly quickly. So that's where I have to think at the moment is, do you go and buy a new unit, which is so much more efficient? I've had friends who have put in a new unit and saved themselves an awful lot of electricity, actually, because of the efficiency. So not always is progress negative. We would sometimes think so by the way we talk, but one has to sometimes think of functional obsolescence, and so all refrigerators sometimes need to be gotten rid of. And perhaps to remind you that further back, when you didn't have a refrigerator, you had an ice box. And locally, we have several ice boxes where, as a commercial ice boxes, where there are warehouses for ice. You would go to the local dam, wait till it freezed over, and saw yourself blocks of ice, and then trundle them along to a storehouse and store them over winter, and deliver those blocks of ice with tongs, and you'd order by how many square feet you wanted. You might have a small ice box that didn't want a lot of ice. Other people would have rather big, large slabs, and they were delivered by horse and cart. So the process of refrigeration has allowed people to benefit from not having to eat food that is tainted, food that required a spice trade in order to give it a flavor that was above the flavor of decomposition. Mm. So it has led to a lot of well health in the U.S. Another form of cooling there was to take a kitchen closet, and you had steel down the sides, and you punched little holes in it. And this allowed for the circulation of water. Then you had a dish of water on the top, and you hung cheesecloth down over the cupboard that was full of holes, and you let the breeze run through, and that would evaporate the water and reduce the temperature. Going into the field, people would have canvas water bags. And as the water came through the canvas, slowly, because it was fairly dense canvas, then the breeze, you'd have two little risers on your front bumper bar, and you would keep your water bag at the front where there was plenty of breeze, and that would cool as you were going along, mainly because it takes calories of energy out as you cool that wet canvas. And get very adept at drinking from a bag that is loose. You somehow lift it up high and just guzzle quickly before your arm runs out of energy, <Blood. laughs> and back you go. Uh-huh. But there's also other economies, and I'm not quite so sure were good. Well, one was that you got used to not drinking much water. It was remarkable when as students, we used to work with farmers, and the farmers would drink very little water, and they would be amazed that students, I was more from a rural setting, so I was more adept at doing this, but city dwellers were used to drinking water and water and water and water, and that's what's recommended these days. Mm-hmm. But it was a strange phenomenon that would be noticed by the locals, how much the neophytes drank during the day. And that's sort of a little bit like many animals will adapt that way.
I had occasion once to sit in on an Arctic engineering class.
Uh-huh.
For my buddy in Anchorage, and he was taking it because he's an engineer. I was visiting at the time, and he said, you might be interested in this. Why don't you come along to class? And they talked about in industrial projects on the North Slope of Alaska, which is essentially a desert tundra.
Yes.
Things like how big a pond has to be so that you can get a supply for your camp, say industrial camp, from it without it freezing solid. And also without it, if it was too big, there'd be a certain inversion or something that you wouldn't want either. I didn't take notes very well.
Okay, the inversion bit is where the temperature changes, the whole pond will invert. And so you've got all that mud and stuff from down low up high. That's what he's probably talking about.
It might have been a dissolved oxygen thing or something.
It was strange how people had to adapt to a very cold and very
rough
climates. The upstairs of many of the prairie houses, the corn country cube or the regular prairie houses, are often not heated upstairs. You went to bed with a brick that's been sitting near the fireplace and wrapped up in clothes, or
you hope the heat rose from the
there were no registers, but there were holes in the floor so that the heat could rise. Some people who are more sophisticated would have a bedpan that was well warmed and had handles and everything.
Well, that's all right. I lived in the city for 5 years, and it was a two flat. My landlady lived upstairs, and I don't think she ever turned her heat on. It was the tenant providing the heat. And it was one of these, speaking of old appliances, it was basically a furnace in the middle of the living room. One of those kind of.
Yes.
And which was scary at first, but then you get used to it, and then you want it. But it didn't circulate the air very well.
You stand in front of it, and you get hot on the front side and cold on the back side.
Exactly. And the blower didn't work for years.
And people would have a tub of water on that, and you would have that would be your bath. If you didn't have much water, and many of these places didn't have much water, especially in Australia, you washed your feet because you'd been running around barefooted all day, and you washed your body on a little dish with water in it on about a 3 foot high stand that you could get your leg up and into the dish, and you'd have baths once every while, and the kids would go first, and you would have a copper. You'd keep a copper, and that was the heat for the water, hot water for the day. And at bathing time, you would take buckets of water in, and kids would go first, and parents would go last. And I could remember scrubbing my father's back with a scrub brush. He loved that. But then we got sophisticated. We got a chip heater. And you put wood in this thing, and it made this sort of sound, and it was putting a rolled up paper or chipped material into this heater that had a surround of water around it, and then it would bubble out as it got hot.
I was thinking of cisterns and barrels this week with the rain coming down and through rather than out of my gutters.
Yes.
In a very concise stream, and thinking of water conservation, yes, it might have been out your way.
Here you had cisterns under practically every large house, had a circular or some form of cistern, a brick cistern, and those are still around today. People open them up and put weeds there and have a compost heap in them, but they're either open from a basement or from outside often, and they would hold a couple of hundred gallons, perhaps even 1,000 gallons of water. Reasonably potable. It's coming off the roof, reasonably clean. The cities used to have at each corner, or each major corner, a huge cistern, because they had no way of transporting 1,000 gallons of water on a fire truck that was pulled by people or by horses. So you would tap into the cistern that it was at the corner of Main and Neal Street, for instance, and that was your fire protection.
And fires were a lot more frequent.
Yes, because especially for wood, there was the use of wood was greater. And if you didn't have wood, if you were on the prairie, for instance, you would put down little sticks of cordgrass which meant that you had a fireplace made basically of wattle and daub, which the Australians used to call it, but I don't know what it's called here, but it's like a peat and with material in it. But it's still got to be framed somehow, because that's subject to rain, subject to breakage. So you had a fireplace that had a lot of flammability. You could plaster it over with limestone or something like that, or whitewash. But it's still a dangerous thing. So sometimes people used to have kitchens that weren't attached to their log cabin house. They had them a little bit away. I've been revising my thoughts on some of these things because I'm preparing to give a little talk at the Pages for All Ages today.
I've been reading
Madsen, and a lot of the things that he's talking about are the things that I grew up with. Not perhaps right then and there, but sometimes a good log cabin house will stay into another generation, even till today. And fairly recently, the Hirschbergers in Atwood unleashed a log cabin that was cladded over. You didn't know it was a log cabin, but there it was. When the guy wanted to build a house, he discovered the log cabin. Usually there was, in this case, there were four houses. Log cabin, frame house, which came later and was more efficient, but still pretty cold because it didn't have insulation in the walls. Then they grew a large family. They became a little affluent, and they had usually something like a Italianate building, two stories with a basement and all the ornate trimmings too in most cases. And then later that family got smaller and it got to be a bungalow. And the bungalow often was in town rather than out in the boondocks. And,
what time since you mentioned it, I will say, were you out there are listening to the Prairie Monk on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Yeah. What time is your talk at Pages for All Ages today?
3 to 4. And we'll talk for a little while and then take questions and introduce some pictures and things like that. But I rather respect Manson, who wrote a book called The Sky Began, because he goes back into some of these sorts of things and explains. We've mentioned it several times, and sometime when I feel that I have the timbre of my voice to do it, I'll I'll read some of his things, but I don't like to read too much because I do it haltingly, and some of your conversation on these things should not be halting. You need to pick a little piece that is good and have it tell.
I don't know, I think the fans demand it.
Well, I thought I'd go back to Australia a little bit. Yeah, I got a phone call yesterday morning. It was my niece's 21st birthday, and the family was letting me share a little in this event. So during the day of Sunday, we've had, or Saturday rather, I've had several contacts there, and some of it is, some brings reminiscence back. One of the things that Madison and others talk about is, once you made it to the U.S., you had left your home country, you had left your home associates, the mail was not easy, you may be in a location where you hardly even could get to town. Especially some of the settlement in the Midwest was, it was early settlement in the forest, but once those people had settled in the forest, what was left was huge acres of prairie. And if you were in the middle of a prairie, you might be almost 20 miles away from a local town or something like that. And it wasn't easy. There were little sloughs in the way. Remarkably enough, the flat prairie is not that flat, and there is. So if people got smart, one little thing I was reading just a few minutes ago was that these guys got smart. They were going to take flour or something like that, 5 ton of flour by road. And this is
what time of year?
It was summertime, actually, but the railroads were in by this time, but there weren't roads. And they got almost to where they were going, and somebody warned them. There were two sloughs you had to go through, and one you nearly got ground in, and the second you certainly got ground in. So they sold their flour for a very modest amount and pulled out of it because they had already gone with 40 miles of very tough driving.
And where the prairie was flat, it could be very, very spongy.
Yes, and that was one of the characteristics of the prairie soil. There's so much organic matter in it that it is friable. That's the difference between a prairie soil now and a fully-fledged agricultural field. Mm. The agricultural field has lost a lot of that organic matter, and the soil is very compact. And so there's a lot more runoff, a lot less absorption immediately. So, yes, things have changed. We should be noting those changes as we go along. So we are planting prairie on a berm of topsoil, but it's compacted by 14%. It's very firm topsoil. And if you were a farmer, you would go into that with a tong and you would rip it open to give it aeration. And we might not have to do that. We planted prairie on it, and the prairie itself will go down with roots 18 feet or 15 feet or miles of fibrous root systems. And over the years, that will become a different soil. And yes, when you went to walk through the prairie, it wasn't an easy, firm base underneath. And if you built a floor in your cabin, you sprinkle salt on it. Most of the log cabins didn't have a floor as such. They didn't have a wooden floor. They had a dirt floor. And you hardened it by putting extra salt in there. And then you could sweep it and work with it. Yeah. So getting back to my phone calls, it was... what I would like to transmit here is that the problem that you face if you've left one country and you haven't quite left it, and you've gone to another country and you haven't quite, you have your feet in two places. I was talking to my niece and I asked her where she was living, and I actually know all the streets round about. My grandmother used to live right there, and so I started to tell her some of the history. I was born just down the road. It's Bondi, which is a very famous beach in Australia, which used to have all these athletic competitions, life-saving competitions, and it's now become a kind of druggy center, and they're forced to sort of sweep and strain the sand several times a day to make sure they don't have any needles sitting around. And it's kind of sad. But when my grandfather first went there, he was English, and he tried to swim between two headlands. Now, if you're in the English Channel, the waves are not high, and it's kind of gentle. But if you tried to go from headland to headland in Australia with huge waves and sharks and all sorts of things, that was absolutely crazy. And so the local surf lifesaving club pull him out of the water, and more or less said, "What the hell are you doing?" The other thing that grandfather didn't realize, he was kind of ginger in complexion and had tender skin in the English situation where he would swim no problem. But in Australia, you're in much closer to the equator, and there's a beaming light there that, and he would get sunburned terribly. And so that was a lesson he had to learn. But then he used to go to the Bondi Baths, and I remember going with grandfather to the Bondi Baths and see all these people who actually swim in the middle of winter, right through the summer, and the icebergers, and they are known for their activities. You can do that in fairly cold water. You can do that as long as you adjust your body to it and do it gradually. And so this is a rather famous little club of people, and they sunbake, and I was, my parents had, by this time, my father had been pastor of a church there and had fallen in love with my mother, who was one of the parishioners, and but father left the church after about 5 years. He mainly felt he wasn't as godly as perhaps his congregation was, so he decided to go school teaching, and he talked a lot to his professor about this. And that was a good thing for him to do. He still maintained his interests, but not as a parsonical person. But there, in the same Bondi as the same Waverley, which is the next door little suburb, there's a church, and there's the registry office where I was registered. And so I was talking to my niece about this and reminding her that she had an uncle buried in the local cemetery, and she didn't really know that she had that I had an older brother that died in just early stages of child, survived several days and had a pulmonary problem, which these days would be no problem at all, but in those days was quite a problem. And so I was encouraging her to go look around these places and find some of the old history that's her family history. I talked to my brother, who is having to deal with Parkinson's disease, and for the first time, and that was I've been reading some of the same books as he's been reading, just because I'm interested in what is happening to him. And he's very laudatory of some of the drugs that are being used, and he's aware of what the time frame is. It may be fast, it may not be so fast. It's one of those things where being well read is helpful. And in a little community, it's a long way to go to specialists, and so we had a kind of academic talk there. My sister's husband lost his brother shortly, so there's another little thing that you have to realize that people are going. No longer will you ever go back to Australia and know a lot of your friends and relatives. He was 20 years older than my sister's husband, but he was part of, very much a part of the family. I was talking to my niece again, and she wanted to say that she had encountered, she's working as an accountant, and she went to the, she was a new job, and she went to the, and she had to handle a file which said Zoe Hall, and she knew this person, and she said to the legal company that she was working with, my family knows this person, and they said, yes, this, was this the same person? And yes, it was. Zoe had been in Tasmania, where somebody went berserk and shot 30 people, and she was one of them. And this was the daughter of one of my old girlfriends. So there is a fund for her and some of the others that were shot in that situation.
In Tasmania, you said?
It was, that happened in Tasmania, the fund is for students at universities that right. don't have a lot of funding. It's a memorial fund.
Is that how your niece found out about the news?
Yeah, she just was working for this legal company, and yeah. my old friend, Margot, comes, the mother, yeah. comes in every once in every month. They have a board meeting, and they distribute money as a memorial. I hadn't heard that end, heard the other aspects. So these are little tidbits that are sort of things that you feel for a lot. I feel for the landscape a lot. That landscape, which I've explained, has a plate tectonics on the east side of Australia. The very dryness of the continent, so my brother sends me pictures of dry area plants that I sometimes find in Rick Orr's shop right here. Banksias and other things. And he goes, visits older places and sends me information about that. The old school hall at the little town where we grew up was called Thora. It was called Never Never before that. And so I have here a picture of the hall. You see, we had a hall. It was a private hall. It was owned by the people at the post office. The post office had the telephone exchange. The telephone exchange was one of these ones with plugs, and you had lots of droppers, and you connected. So if you wanted to make a phone call, you didn't have your own phone. You see, you went to the corner store, and you had a box that looked like it had swinging doors on it, like bar doors, and you would stick your head in this box with a phone, and your backside would be out. If it was raining, the backside would be wet. You'd have previously gone to the telephone exchange. This happened all over the world. This is nothing different than from here. You would say you want number six, so you'd get number six lined up, and they would ring a manual ring. You didn't have batteries. You created your own dynamo, and you rang, and so the box outside would ring, and you'd run in and take your phone call, and then it depends. If it was a party line, immediately there would be click, 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 click. There were about half a dozen. You'd be talking to half a dozen people, and so you'd that wasn't always the case. If you were going to the town, then you're more likely to have a single call. But this was communication par excellence, and so you all chatted on the phone for a while, and then you could be rude and say, well, okay, you guys, you can all hang up now except for whoever I want to talk to.
Sure.
So if you were lucky, you would hear clicks and they'd hang up. So there was a petrol blouser. Petrol is the Australian word for gas. So you had to pump the gas up. You didn't. It wasn't. There was no electricity in this situation, you see, so You pumped the gas up 6 gallons. You saw it run into a big bowl, and then you let it drain out into your car. So mail and a little corner store, and a parrot. The parrot was very astute. He always knew when the mail was coming. He could seem to identify the mail car from about 4 miles down the road.
Service car.
By the time the car arrived, everyone knew that the mail was in, and so the people would wander over. There wasn't too many people in this little village, probably three or four, but you sure knew that the service car would arrive. There was a blacksmith shop, and he would shoe horses and repair sulky wheels and things like that. There were the old maids across the road. They had retired to a position near the post office, but they were very staunch Methodists, and they would sit on the front stoop with their Bible, and they knew what kids went off to dance and whatever. But the post office did have a dance hall, and it got to be awkward. It was also doubling as a place for repairing cars and things, and it was hard to schedule, so the locals decided to put in a new dance hall. And so I have a photograph in front of me of the new dance hall. It's still pretty small, but it's got a recent addition of a veranda on it. But it's lights. We used to have to go down and pump up the acetylene lamps, and every once in a while, in the middle of the dance or whatever event, the gas would hit a little sack that was a silken sack, and that would be the equivalent of a tungsten thread. It would light up, and it would break perhaps or something like that. But the floor was, this was a new floor, and they put down tallow wood, which is a wood that is very, very slippery. And dancers that did the shotties and all those things you would do in country places, probably not done in the city so much because the city had surpassed that sort of era. They wanted fast shoes and fast feet, fast wood. So you would get there about a day before, and you would take sawdust and you'd put some kerosene in it, and you'd take tallow candles and cut them up, and you'd heat it in a big flat dish over a galley fire. A galley fire is an open fire where we would normally cook the water for the kitchen to make tea and things like that and wash up. So you would heat this gently and so it was warm, and then you'd sprinkle this all over the floor, and you would move it back and forth with huge brooms and make sure that this was a very fast floor. And if you were a kid that didn't realize that this was a very fast floor, you could really lose your cool, because kids didn't wear shoes very much, so when they wore shoes, they had a very tough sole. They weren't worn in very well. So you could hit that floor and take a skid. And that's where you learned to dance, you see. You had
real fast.
Yes. You had progressive dances, and so people would circle in one direction, circle in the other direction, and then you'd pick the partner that was opposite you. Well, those of us that didn't know how to dance very well got to learn to dance by running into and making an extra person, you see. So you would get to do a couple of turns, and then there'd be some silly soul standing out there. He'd lost out. So the next time he was ready, he was back in the line. Oh. So and all the children would come, and the children would be in the powder rooms or whatever, with blankets, and usually a local band with violin and drums and piano. Mrs. Henson used to play the piano from about 6 inches above the keys. So, and all the soundboards were off the piano. And then halfway through the night, you would get the cups out, and the kids would take the cups around in big drums, and everyone would get a cup, and then the sandwiches and the tea and whatnot would come around. And it was very male-female. The women stayed in seating inside. The men usually stayed outside. And it was, that was the way things were.
And organized.
It was a little tough because we were on the bottomlands and we'd hold our events, but up on the uplands, we talked a little bit last week about having rainforest on the uplands. Well, there were timber getters on the uplands, and they were rather rough and tough. And they would come down to our church hall and do things like roll beer bottles across the floor, or they had these certain rules, like if you brought a gal, you would have the first dance and the last dance, and if that got violated, then there would be some fisticuffs, or some smart ass would go in and put a beer bottle under each tire of a vehicle. Ooh. So when it moved off, you had this large wow. But so we didn't always advertise up the hill in Dorrigo. We talk about some of these things. There was Bross's Bridge just up the road. There was a little church that was shared by the Presbyterians and the Methodists. And so my brother went to take a photograph of it. It's long since been sold to someone, and they have all sorts of shrubbery around it. He said that his taking photographs wasn't really appreciated, but this was the old place as far as he was concerned. And we would have Presbyterians at some times. We had a Reverend Doran, who was very Scottish in many ways, and his wife would play the doxology on the Presbyterian church has a doxology which comes into being very often, and she would play it with great vigor. And then the Methodists would come, and the Methodists were slightly different. They were often missionaries, and so we had one Methodist parson who had been in Fiji, which in those days were still sort of a very different society. And I can remember slideshows, which were old lantern slides, glass with the negative between two big pieces of glass, and you put it in this great blunderbuss that showed the projection. No 2x2 slide business. If you took a slideshow to someone, you really took a lot of equipment. It was heavy, and you could easily break those if you dropped on those things. But up the road, across from the church is, what else can we say about the church? I can remember harvest festivals, which are sort of like Thanksgiving, and church would be decked out with Burrawong palms. These are tropical, subtropical rainforest palms, and each church windows having a certain structure, you would have to be crossed over with palms, and there would be citrus fruit and big pumpkins and the usual things that you get at a Thanksgiving festival here. It's just across the road now is a timber mill, and timber is a problem if you don't have you have very old soils, Silurian slates and shales that have been very well leached, and so they don't grow very good forests. And I wonder what they're making. It's probably boxwood. It's a little bit like the industry here. The greatest users of timber in Illinois, for instance, or in the U.S., are for crates, for pallets. And it's a fairly wasteful use of trees in a way, but it means that all the bottomlands, there's a forest industry in Champaign County, there's a forest industry in all of east central Illinois, and constantly taking out trees that are rough and tough trees, perhaps, but they're used in the rougher forms of wood distribution. So here's Bross's Bridge. Bross's Bridge was a wooden bridge. It rattled. You could hear it from 3 miles away. You knew when some car was going over Bross's Bridge. It had planks that were totally loose. These are 3-inch by 8-inch planks, and they're worn loose on the end. So rattle, 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 rattle. They quieted down by putting planks longwise. So that helps some, but you can always tell. And you can usually tell what sort of vehicle is coming, if it's a lightweight car or My father had learned to drive. He'd taught himself, and he would come to the hill that went down to Brosses Bridge, and he would stop and put the car in low gear and go down, boom, 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 and then he'd speed up and go across the bridge. He knew how to change up then, but to change down in a crash gearbox, if you're coming to a hill fast, you need to rev your engine to bring it up to the speed of the wheels if you're going to go down. So it's called double declutching, and so he didn't do that. It's a little hard on the vehicle also, because they're using the vehicle's engine as a brake, and that's how most people did it. They double declutched and went down the hill, the same as my father did with caution, because it was, these roads were steep and they were likely to have a right angle bend at the bottom, and if you weren't very careful, you had an appointment with the local oak tree. These bridges were put in with pylons, and so the pylons have been, the bridge has been replaced by a concrete bridge, of course, and so there's a pylon, and so my brother has taken a photograph of the old bridge pylons with a heron sitting on the bank, these are kind of interesting. I watch when I'm waiting for my computer to come up, I look at some of these sorts of things to remind myself of a straight and roof type. So for instance, you are quite different from here. You have a rolled roof over a veranda, sort of that curves down, and you've got to compromise. Sometimes the Australians haven't got really Australian. They're sometimes using things that have been written for them in England. And sometimes the fun of Cork is that they get the plans mixed up. So in one town, Bathurst, which is near where my brother lives, the post office looks just like an Indian post office. Well, guess what? The plans got mixed up, folks. So there it is. I'm looking at some relatives that are up towards Queensland, and you have to remember that most of the access to these little coastal rivers was by coastal boat. And you didn't have good wharves to come in, where you couldn't, there weren't bays. Sometimes you're fortunate to have a bay. Sydney Harbour is an excellent bay, but often you're out there on your own, and there's some sort of wharf that goes out, a jetty that goes out, and people used to be landed by basket. You got the crane and you got people in the basket, and you had a boat floating around and a fairly heavy swell underneath, and people often got very sick as they were landing. But those boats were built with wood from the rainforest that we were talking about last week, the little outliers that came through as the plate tectonics moved things, the volcanic material was able to come through and make an outlier, and they made for big, straight, tropical trees that were good for boat building.
Were they all forested out, or what is...
Yes, they're about forested out now, and so the people are like my counterparts, so we run around in Australia trying to save the last little inch of tropical rainforest, because there ain't much left, folks. It was very, very good soil under the volcanic, where all the surrounding soil is very poor. Silurian things, slates and shales that leached. And then there's I'm looking at a drowned river. A drowned river is where you have climate changes. Apart from the plate tectonics, the world, if the ice caps melt, that's one of our problems for the future. If humans get to change the temperature of things much, the ice caps melt. Ross ice cap is melting at the present time. Two huge parts of it have melted. When that happens, a lot of water goes into the seas, and you can drown a river system, and it's called an estuary. So Sydney Harbour is an estuary. And what I'm looking at is Hawkesbury River, which is a sort of a drowned river, and it has islands in it. They're a little bit like Maine when you look at Arcadia and places like that. You have little islands sitting out in the middle, and often in the Australian situation, the regular landscape around is not very good soil, not very good trees, a lot of sandstone and shale, and you can see that in that sort of picture.
You've been listening to the Prairie Monk on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM.
So,
well, since we only have 2 minutes,
you got some announcements there?
Yeah, okay. We only have 2 minutes.
I would like to say that we're facing some seed collecting problems. I was collecting New Jersey tea on Saturday, and I was very pleased to know that it's about ripe right now. So those of you who are interested in seed collection should be thinking about that, and call us if you have some time, because we would direct you to a prairie where we need to collect fairly rare seed, and it has to be done at the right time. It just doesn't wait for you to sit around and decide when to collect it.
All right, let's wrap. This has been...
this is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
I'm Bill Saylor. Thanks for tuning in with us.
Thanks for listening.
We'll be back again in a week, as usual.
You have just been listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Prairie Monk program, originally aired here on WEFT Radio 90.1 FM on August 25th, 2002, basically 20 years ago. Some of Dave's memories from his hometown in Australia and a bunch of other stuff, kind of the usual for this program. Thank you for tuning in. I am Bill Saylor, back in the present day here, being August 28th. 2022. So the show ended a bit early for the hour, trimmed down a little bit, but that gives us time to fit in a song request by recent guest Kathy Martin. So we're going to play John Welton and the Awakening. The song is The World Today, from the album 1111, as in the time 11:11, and it's actually really kind of clever. It's a double album with 11 tracks on each side, and the graphics on the album cover are and play along the same lines. Let's put it that way. So here's some jammy goodness from John Welton and the Awakening. The World Today. You're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Soon after will be Shruti Music of India. Thanks for tuning in.
To an end, yeah. because it gives me the blues. Even when I turn it off, it's still going on. There's a war that we can't ignore anymore. Whatever happened to the golden rule? Why are there metal detectors in the elementary schools? The children of tomorrow are the ones who pay for the mistakes we made today. So let the love grow from here to everywhere. I can feel changes in the air. It's in the air. Let the love flow from us to them before the world we know comes to an end. I think the time has finally come to plant a new seed. We can hope that it will come to see the light of day. There's more to life than what you're reading in your news feed. Wake up and be the light that chases all this darkness away. Afraid to love to see tomorrow. It's part of life, I know it happens every day. But deep inside, we all know there's gotta be a better way. There's got to be a better way. Gives me the blues, even when I turn it off, it's still going on. There's a war that we can't ignore anymore. Whatever happened to the golden rule? Why are there metal detectors in the elementary schools? The children of tomorrow are the ones who pay for the mistakes we made today. So let the love grow from here to everywhere.